Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
How's everyone doing tonight? Justin here, and I wanted to let you know that Aaron and I have taken this week off. As some of you may know, I lost my brother, Christopher, back in 2004. He suffered from severe mental illness and addiction issues. Last Thursday, April 8th, I lost my sister, Megan. My mother found her dead from an apparent overdose. If you're currently in distress or struggling with addiction, I implore you to seek help. Today's episode is one that we recorded on January 22nd, 2018. It was a premium episode, so most of you probably haven't heard it. I think it's simultaneously the most appropriate and inappropriate episode we could put out right now. It covers the Silk Road, and we hope you enjoy.
How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing good, Justin.
Tonight's episode is a subject that I got obsessed with when it was in the news. This is an obsession like anyone's obsession with true crime. I just wanted to consume as much information about it as possible. I've always been fascinated with cybercrime. When the Silk Road hit the mainstream, I was fascinated by all the facets of it, the VPNs, the BitTorrents, the Tor network, the deep web. Do you remember when it hit, Aaron? Were you even paying attention?
You mean the BitTorrents?
Well, just Silk Road in general.
No, not at all, because that's something I never read about, never got into. And then something that's actually a big part of this case is Tor. It's a way to anonymize yourself while online. I have some familiarity with that. But as far as Silk Road goes, no. I mean, I think in the entire time it was going on, I think I read a very short article about someone being arrested. I think that was it.
And you have to download a Tor browser. This was actually created by the Naval Research Group and DARPA. So if there was ever a time of war and our internet backbone was down or crippled, the military could still send messages to each other and still get commands and orders out there. So the military and the American government built this deep web.
Yeah, people are always saying that DARPA has made some very, very bad stuff. And here it is that they've made this Tor browser that can make it easier for people to conduct illegal activities online.
Yeah. Everything is more or less a tool, and it's how you use it. It could be used for good or bad.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I was pretty obsessed with this. Even on my peripheral podcast, I interviewed a man named Brock, and he would go out to the Silk Road and buy his drugs because he lived out in the middle of nowhere and wasn't able to get them on the street. And then he ended up becoming a dealer himself because he was the only guy that could get heroin in a small town. And his story really is an overarching somebody getting addicted to opiates and prescription drugs and then moving up to heroin and harder drugs and then even becoming the dealer himself, then his downfall. Let's get to the story and stop talking about it.
Yeah, why don't you give them the title of this episode?
So my peripheral episode was called The Road to Hell is Paved in Silk. And this is because it was based off the Silk Road. The Silk Road was the website that a man named Ross Ulbricht had created. You could sell and buy drugs and a lot of other things completely anonymous and out of the light of the government and no oversight, no regulations. So Ross Ulbricht, if you saw him or met him, he was your quintessential college granola kid. I call him granola because he wasn't quite a hippie, but he would wear the plaid and the cutoff jeans and whatnot. But he wasn't a hippie because, well, he was a capitalist. He was an idealist full of hopes and dreams. His sister and him had filmed, I guess, a tryout video for whatever that stupid reality show was, The Amazing Race, where you have to get across the country by all means necessary and show up at some point and you would win $1 million. He was quite a adventurous guy. So was his sister. They wanted to win the million and split the money.
It can't be that stupid if there's $1 million at the end of it, Justin.
I think reality shows are dumb.
Right. But I understand why people are participating if there's that much money involved.
Yes, it's stupid money. But what Ross won't understand is in a few years from the time that they filmed their tryout video, which was rejected and denied outright, he would be making $500,000 a day. Yeah.
Well, it just shows how life can take turns you're not expecting.
Exactly. He was such a disheveled looking kid. He lived out of two garbage bags. He had all of his clothes in and his laptop. That was all of his worldly possessions. He was not materialistic at all. He lived in a basement of an apartment complex, rent-free pretty much. He would do weird things, like he didn't shower with hot water for a month just to test himself to see if he could go without the conveniences of the modern day. He went to the University of Texas at Dallas. He got a bachelor's degree in physics. He would go on to Penn State and get a master's in material science and engineering. And he studied crystallography, which is some weird science that determines the arrangements of atoms or something. I don't even know.
Wait a minute. So this non-materialistic, highly educated man needs to run an illegal website?
Well, yes. He's like one of those geniuses that isn't challenged in life. He tried the dot-com bust, and he lost his ass. He also tried day trading and lost all of his money with that, too. While he was in college, he was very much involved with libertarian groups and groups about free market, free thought. And he really was an idealist and a believer, and he would go to debates on the college campus to debate libertarianism and how you should be free to do with what you will, you know, do anything with your body, ingest anything into your body, have the freedom to do whatever you want as long as you're not harming others without government oversight, of course. So because he had a successful family and friends and he was floundering, doing nothing with his life, he thought, well, I'll take my libertarian belief and I'll take my motivation and due diligence and I will do something with it. He was very much into marijuana and psychedelic mushrooms. He would learn how to grow these things. He would start programming and creating this website that he built completely on the Tor network or the Onion network, however you want to call it, using VPNs and an encrypted laptop. His laptop would have two profiles on it. One was for Ross and his personal life, and the other half was his secret identity. He spent about $50,000. I have no idea where he got this money from, maybe loans or his parents. And he started a mushroom grow operation that he had in this crappy shack of a place that he spent maybe $1,000 a month on, and he built this website.
So the website was to sell mushrooms?
It was much more than that. The website was to give drug dealers a safe platform to sell their drugs.
So this is sort of an eBay type operation where sellers could come on and buyers could come on and transactions could happen, only they're dealing in illegal goods.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. And he is the CEO of this hidden secret eBay. And he is going to take a commission off every sale on the site. But nobody knows what this site is. People that are involved with illegal activities are going to be a little bit hesitant to just jump on a site and start selling drugs because it might be a honeypot trap by law enforcement. So he has to be the first dealer on the site, and he is the first merchant or seller on the site.
Not to derail you too much, but to explain a honeypot, it's basically something that's so attractive that people will want to try it out, right?
Yeah.
To entrap criminals.
Yeah. Here's a car, an unlocked vehicle parked on the side of the road in a not so great part of town, and it's bugged and wired to trap whoever tries to steal the car. Or the actual saying, it's a honeypot that's supposed to attract flies and then they can't get out. You know,
they're also used to trap hackers.
Yeah. He's the first seller on the site selling mushrooms, and to drum up interest or drive traffic to the site, he goes out to tons of drug forms, like one's called the Shroomery, where a bunch of guys that grow and do psychedelic mushrooms go and talk and hang out online. And so he'll go out there and he'll say, "Hey guys, have you seen this new Silk Road site? It's kind of cool. It looks like you can buy and sell illegal drugs. Check it out."
That sounds like spam, though, right?
Well, it was serious, though, because it was in the form and people were like, hey, I got these mushrooms. They're really good. And then he would reply like, hey, you probably try selling them on this site. Have you ever heard of it?
So some people end up trying it out and then they have a good result from it. And that just builds up the business.
Yeah, it's word of mouth, grassroots here. In order to go on these drug forms, you have to register an account with an email address or whatnot, and then post your messages and all that. Ross is just starting out, so he's not thinking about how to protect himself. He's thought of a lot of things, such as the Tor network, VPNs and whatnot, but he's still amateur. And I just have to say it, he's not a criminal. So he's not thinking like a criminal quite yet. He's just thinking of security.
In his heart, he believes that what he's doing really shouldn't be illegal.
Oh, yeah. That's his whole point of this website, which we shouldn't gloss over, is he 100% believes drugs should be legal. And he thinks his website's going to change the government and society and the laws. He 100% does not acknowledge that what he's doing is wrong or immoral in any way.
Okay. So he doesn't believe it's immoral. And he also has something of a point, because that's why alcohol is legal in the United States. Because it was banned for a time, but so many people were doing it, eventually it just became stupid to fight it.
Yeah, exactly. And he thinks he's the Al Capone or whatever of the, speakeasies online. The shack he's renting for his grow operation, his landlord shows up one day because he thinks he has a leaky toilet or something, and walks in and sees what Ross is doing and threatens to call the cops on him.
It's kind of like one of those situations where he walks up and says, Ventura. And he says, yes, Satan. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were somebody else.
Yes. Ross has to hastily move his grow operation somewhere else. And at the same time, the only thing Ross is doing with his time is running a nonprofit book selling company where you read a book that's sitting on your shelf. Well, you donate it to his nonprofit and then he resells it and ships it out to somebody else, or he donates them to prisons. Well, now he's got this Silk Road operation. So he's using his nonprofit to ship drugs out now, not just books. And he has a girlfriend named Julia who he confides in. That's his second mistake. I'll let you figure out his first one. He's running out of time in his day doing a nonprofit organization, having a girlfriend, and running a drug website on the Tor network.
We experience those problems, We have day jobs and we have the podcast and then families.
It's very relatable, even though what he's doing is criminal, but it's relatable because he has problems just like anyone else. So his nonprofit book selling company is a big warehouse. It's like a shipping warehouse, and all the books are on shelves categorized in the back. And he is shipping mushrooms out of this warehouse. And one day he hears this huge ruckus, just this huge crash, and he thinks he's being raided. He thinks he's been caught. And this is very early on in the inception of the Silk Road, but he's paranoid as hell. And the noises and the banging stops, and he walks to the back warehouse where he sees that one of the bookshelves has collapsed and then knocked into another bookshelf. And then you had this big domino effect where all of his books just get thrown onto the floor. He takes this as a sign to shut down his nonprofit because he doesn't have the time for it. And even though it's kind of a front for him to ship drugs, he doesn't need it to ship drugs. He can do that from anywhere. It just shows his paranoia that something happens. He immediately thinks it's the cops banging on his door. He will recoup his $50,000 that he invested into this pretty quickly, selling the mushrooms on the site, because he gets huge profits and it doesn't cost much for him to grow them. The site's growing in popularity, and Gawker puts out an article about it. It goes pretty viral and brings a lot more popularity to the site. A lot more merchants or new sellers start joining the site. We were talking about how this is kind of like eBay, right? Well, Ross wrote the code for this site himself, and he's not a programmer. He's not a developer at all. Like, we sell our merchandise on our site. Well, we have to have a shopping cart to do that. So you put an item in the shopping cart and then you check out. Well, he couldn't use a shopping cart because that would be tied back to him. So he had to take code from a shopping cart and copy it into his site. Well, when you use a lot of these shopping cart apps, they will take a small percentage of the sale. And that's how you pay for the shopping cart app. Well, he's using Bitcoin for all the transactions. Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency that's all digital. Well, the shopping cart app that he stole code from was still trying to take a percentage of every sale, but it had nowhere to go because he wasn't registered to any company. So Bitcoins were just falling out into the ether with every sale. And he was losing money. And his site almost went bankrupt right after the Gawker article went live because he had so many transactions. Again, whenever we talk about any criminal, serial killer, whatever, people think they're these mad geniuses. And this guy was almost through before he even started.
Well, he was a genius, but he was not utilizing his genius in this operation, it seems like.
He wasn't utilizing other people's resources because he was doing it all himself.
The drive for him here was more of his libertarianism.
Yeah.
Rather than his education.
Yeah. I mean, he was a smart guy. I'm not trying to say he was an idiot. I mean, this guy would probably run circles around me, but he was not a developer. But yet he taught himself programming languages and literally built eBay from scratch. So it's not perfect. His coding will be crap this entire time, and he will be hacked over and over, and there'll be flaws and security holes and in just this shopping cart business of him almost going broke while the site's popularity grows.
You really can't do it all on your own.
No. So he has to bring in other people and not tell them what he's doing. And he has one friend that's like a, I guess he's a professor at some college, and he has him fix his shopping cart issue and fix some of his security holes. And then he pays this man with magic mushrooms. So again, I don't know how good or how quality this new code even is, but he's trucking along.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, ZipRecruiter. Are you having trouble with not enough applicants with the right skills or experience applying for your opening, or too many resumes to sort through? Maybe you need to hire someone to wear many hats, which can always be challenging. Sure, you can post your job to a job board and hope that the right person comes along. ZipRecruiter can help you find qualified candidates fast, and now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Whether you need to hire a civil engineer in New York, a pediatric nurse in Nebraska, or an attorney in Colorado, ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. It's so effective that 4 out of 5 employees who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. From an accountant to a zoologist and everything in between, ZipRecruiter makes hiring easier. And right now you can try it for free at our only our listeners get it link, ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/GenY today to try ZipRecruiter for free. We get credit for sending you. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenWHY. We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
After the Gawker article came out, a New York senator named Chuck Schumer gets wind of this demon sight, this bane on our society, and he holds a Senate hearing where he talks about the site and how the government needs to shut it down. What happens when, like, Marilyn Manson or some obscene band is coming to town and you have a bunch of church groups or Mothers Against Bad Makeup protesting them saying, don't come to town? What happens?
Well, it's the difference between, oh, hey, I can't believe I missed that concert. They were here just last weekend and I didn't know the band was playing. I love that band. And, oh, look, guess who's going to be here next weekend?
Or who is this band and why are they so horrible? Now I'm definitely going to go check it out.
Yeah, everybody's talking about this band. I'm going to go give it a listen for myself.
So all press is good press. And Chuck Schumer literally gave Ross Ulbricht and the Silk Road the best infomercial ever. And his site exploded at that point. So he has an influx of popularity, tons more merchants and sellers. And of course, he's getting this commission off every sale. His girlfriend doesn't quite agree with his website because at first she's like, oh, there's just a bunch of potheads selling mushrooms and weed and ecstasy. But now they're selling heroin. Now they're selling fentanyl. And then a merchant registers and is selling guns, firearms on the site. As soon as you start selling guns in a black market, I don't know if I'm okay with that.
Well, and so here's the question. If someone ingests a drug, they can harm themselves, right?
Yeah.
At least we're talking about direct harm. When you sell a gun, though, illegally, then you're giving people the ability to harm others.
Exactly. If there's no background check, there's no check and balance here. Anyone can buy it. And if you're buying a gun off the Silk Road, I don't think you're just a regular responsible gun owner going to the shooting range. I think you're buying that gun because, well, you're a criminal. So,
but why didn't he recognize this?
Well, he was a believer in his libertarianism and everything goes in. Everything is free market without government oversight. It's a very extreme version of libertarianism.
I was going to say, because libertarianism can mean as long as you're not harming anyone else, it should fly, right?
Yeah.
But selling illegal guns, that gets into a whole different area when you talk about personal rights and what is freedom. So for me, yeah, that starts to be a questionable thing.
Yeah, I think I'm drawing a line there too. Between the Senate hearing and now guns being sold on the site, his girlfriend Julia has kind of had enough. She is not cool with this. And she will end up breaking up with Ross. She will hang out with her friend Erica and they will be smoking pot. And Julia will just have to tell Erica, I have a secret that I want to tell you. My ex-boyfriend Ross is running the Silk Road. Shortly after that, Erica and Julia get into a huge fight and they're still hanging out with Ross, even though they're broken up. Ross will end up throwing Erica out of his apartment. Now Erica has this secret.
And a chip on her shoulder.
Yeah. The next day, Erica will post on Ross's Facebook wall, I wonder if law enforcement would be interested in your drug dealing site. So it's posted on his wall for all to see. He deletes it. He makes a frantic phone call to Erica, crying and screaming for forgiveness and to not tell anybody else. She feels sympathy for him and promises not to tell anybody else. But again, you're kind of seeing that as much as we all think that we're so smart and can beat the system, we're all human and we innately screw everything up. So he's a smart guy with all of his technology and safety things, but it takes one person. And he's told now his girlfriend, who has told Erica, and he's ended up telling his college professor guy who helps him with the code what he's doing. So he's told three people now. He will befriend a guy named Variety Jones on the site, who goes by VJ, and Variety Jones will end up being his right-hand man. He will give Ross a lot of advice about how he should run the site and how he should conceal his identity. And they come up with calling him the Dread Pirate Roberts, which if you've seen The Princess Bride, you know what the Dread Pirate Roberts is, or DPR for short. And essentially, it's a pirate who goes by this name, but he'll step down and somebody else will step up and they become the Dread Pirate Roberts. So it's this ongoing cycle of the Dread Pirate, but it's different people who take the helm.
Now, is this because he's looking down the road and thinking, he's looking down the Silk Road and thinking, eventually I will step aside. Maybe I've made enough money and someone else will take this operation over?
It depends on the day you ask him. Yes, he's thinking that, or he's thinking, I'm the Dread Pirate Roberts. I am not Ross. So it's plausible deniability. On the website for his moderators and amongst his minions, he goes by Captain, not the Captain, but just Captain. So no True Crime Garage here. he will run a tight ship and he rules with sort of an iron fist. At one point, he decides to change the commission rates on the site. So if you're selling any drugs, like a small item sale that's like $50 or less, he takes 10% of the sale. But if you're selling more, like larger quantities, then he only takes like 1% of the sale. So he's trying to drive larger quantity sales on the site. And when this happens, well, what happened when Patreon said they were going to change their rates? People get pissed. People revolt and they attack and shame and whatever. And when you're running a deep web criminal site and people don't like your new rates, well, they start hacking the site. They start holding the site ransom. They start threatening the people that run the site.
It's mutiny.
Yes, it literally is mutiny. And his right-hand man, Variety Jones, who is registered as a seller on the site and is very active in the forums, nobody knows that he's actually the right-hand man helping run the Silk Road. So Variety Jones will hang out in the forums and kind of identify who the troublemakers are and identify how bad the problem is, and then report back to Ross, who then in turn will ban people from the site or try to smooth things over. But Ross pretty much tells everybody to go FO and deal with it because he created this and they're only here because of his creation. And if they don't like it, then leave. So he's not making friends. On top of this, you have pot dealers selling alongside gun dealers. You can only imagine that they're not getting along either. And the pot dealers are not cool with gun dealers. And the gun dealers are like, shut up, hippie. there's a lot of infighting on the site. So Ross has to hire moderators to keep people from fighting and flaming each other. I mean, this is just like eBay. This is just like, hell, our Facebook group for Gen Y. We have to have moderators so things don't break out, right?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you operate within a vacuum. You only know about how you've been triggered, and then you have to deal with that, and you don't think about the effects of what will happen once you start shaming somebody or getting angry. But this bringing in moderators, though, he has to give them elevated privileges.
Yes, he does. He has to give them access to the site. But when he vets these people, they have to send him a copy of their driver's license that they've scanned or taken a photo of. They have to expose their identity to him while he still stays anonymous. They want to help. They want to be part of the site. They want to be part of the movement. So they're willing to do these things.
Justin, let's talk about a man by the name of Jared Dare Yeghayan.
I'm glad you said his name because I would have butchered it. Around the inception of the Silk Road, which was in 2011, Jared was working at the Chicago airport. He was a customs and immigration official He worked for DHS, and he started to see an influx of drugs coming through the airport. Specifically, he saw these very ornate envelopes that would have a single pink ecstasy pill in them. He would have the, I guess, mail collectors start bringing him all of these envelopes or packages of drugs.
Because the envelopes were so unique, it was easy to say, here's what we're looking for, and then they could collect all of them.
Yeah.
Because it was a system put in place by the people selling these.
And he would check the manifests. He would see specific return addresses or no return address, specific phone numbers, just things that were registered. And he figured out a formula, a method to identify when drugs were coming through his airport. But this dude was new. He was a rookie. He had only been on the job like months. He's a smart guy and he's diligent. He will start informing other officials, other customs agents at other airports, JFK and other ports around the country, and start telling them, giving them the formula of what to look for. And he's really good at his job. But he starts stepping on people's toes because this new guy is so good at his job, he's making others look bad. His supervisor will actually tell him to back off and give him like a dressing down, I guess. This will go on for a few months, and then Jared will pretty much get fed up and say, I'm doing my job. You can't stop me. All future communications with me will have to be in writing or through my lawyer. And that's that.
But isn't this real life? You get someone who's just too good at what they're doing, and then everyone else gets upset.
Yeah, it's jealousy, it's pride, whatever.
And those things are more important than getting your job done correctly,
yeah,
or efficiently.
It's all politics, even at the customs level. I mean, this guy's not a huge agent. He's a dude that checks passports and checks mail buckets that come in on airplanes. That's it. And he's pissing people off. Jared is slowly figuring out that there's this thing called the Silk Road where people can buy and sell drugs online. It's not so private anymore. And he asks his supervisor about the Silk Road and his partner, and they're like, oh yeah, everybody knows about the Silk Road. There's hundreds of cases about it. And Jared will go out and search for cases, and no one's logged a case about it. He's like the first guy to start logging cases about the Silk Road because everyone else just figures they're doing it. Everyone knows about the Silk Road, but no one has filed a report on it yet. Go figure. Meanwhile, you have another man named Karl Marx Force the Fourth, but he's pretty much goes by Carl. He's an ex-DEA agent who had a drinking problem and he got a DUI. And so they gave him, I think they call it a solar agent job, which pretty much you're given a desk job where you just show up when the sun comes up and you go home before the sun goes down. And he's in this dead-end position, but he was a very aggressive door kicker in his drug-fighting days. Well, Jared and others are asking the government and forces that be for resources to fight this horrible bane on society, Silk Road. And Carl gets a visit to his desk. Hey, if you want, you can help investigate this Silk Road thing. And I said ex-DEA agent, but really he was still a DEA agent, just kind of reassigned. There's a bunch more agents that get assigned to this, but I'm just going to go through some of the more big names here. Chris Tarbell was the lead FBI investigator and kind of the team lead that started bringing all of the investigators and all of the operations across the United States together to work together. And then you have the assistant DA, Saren Turner. When he shows up, everybody stops talking and listens because he's a big deal. And then you have an IRS agent by the name of Gary Alford. And Gary was obsessed with the Silk Road, like a lot of people get. He saw that Gawker article and he read it three times. And I guess Gary has a weird tick where he does everything three times. I don't know. And Gary, because he's pretty much an IRS agent and kind of a very thorough type A personality, he does a Google search for the Silk Road and the time frame of like 2011 when it first came on to the market. And he narrows his search down to just a few hits. And all these hits he's getting are literally on these little drug websites like the Shroomery, where he's seeing posts by a guy saying, hey, you guys should go check out Silk Road. And it's by a guy that's going by the name Altoid. Gary will contact these websites, these drug sites, and say, hey, give me the information on these accounts. And a lot of the accounts are registered under a name called Frosty, which is bogus. But one of them is registered under a Gmail account called rossulbrich@gmail.com. So this IRS agent literally solved the case in 15 seconds of who was running the Silk Road with a few Google searches. But who does he tell? He is assigned to the Silk Road Task Force. He thinks, oh, I'm the guy. I'm the number one star in the show. And he is summoned to go to this FBI building where Saren Turner and Chris Tarbell are at. He shows up to a room full of other superstars and other investigators who have tons of information that they've been gathering on the Silk Road, including Jared, who is very diligent. And Gary feels a little deflated, I guess. He doesn't think that he's as important as he once felt. And after Jared stands up and talks about this like 2-year investigation he's been running and all the evidence he's collected, Gary doesn't feel like speaking up during this meeting. And he literally has the name of the owner of the Silk Road in his back pocket.
Which no one else has?
No. No one has this guy's identity. But there's a lot of infighting here at this meeting too, because Chris Tarbell and Saren Turner are saying, okay, everybody give us everything you got. Well, every law enforcement officer and department wants the bust for themselves. They want to own it. They want the credit. So they start telling them, well, this is an active investigation and I can't give you this information. And then they start fighting and arguing, just being jerks to each other. And this really bothers me. Government departments are supposed to work together. That's their job. They're the government. And they operate in these silos where they feel they are the most important self-perpetuating department in the government. A silo is actually a corporate term. It has nothing to do with criminal activity. In corporations, departments will feel that they are more important than other departments. And they will not share information or work well with others. They become a silo and not integrated.
Right. That's how you solve things. You don't repair anything. You don't say, okay, here's how it will work from here on out. You have to create a whole other department to handle the problem.
This might be a little bit of a stretch, but when 9/11 happened and we were attacked, the U.S. government was blind to this because the CIA had one side of the conversation from the terrorists over on the other side of the world, and the FBI had the other side of the conversation of the ones here in the States, but they wouldn't talk to each other. And we had thousands of American lives lost because two U.S. government departments didn't feel like playing ball. And now we have the Department of Homeland Security that has over 230,000 employees, over a $40 billion budget, because two other departments won't talk to each other. We have multiple departments sitting in this room talking about the Silk Road that won't play ball with each other. This is why people like Ross exist. These anti-government, you know, leave me alone, get off my yard kind of people, because they see the government bloat. They see the government incompetencies and they think, well, why should you tell me what to do when you can't even do it right yourself? And I think this is I guess this is why I see Ross behave the way he does, is because he sees all the same issues and problems that arise. And his own investigation just kind of shows how poorly the government can get along with each other.
But Mr. Alford here, who had this critical information to the case, doesn't utilize it.
No.
And I know I have this picture in my head of all these guys in a room. They're all just different departments, but they all have their little bit of information on Osama bin Laden. And here you've got a guy in the back of the room who's literally got the corpse of Osama bin Laden under his chair. Instead of participating, instead of walking up through the middle of the room, dragging Osama towards the front and saying, "Guess what, guys, it's over." Instead of doing that, it's like he drags Osama out the back door and is like, "All right, they don't like me. They don't want me.
They don't need me."
That makes no sense to me.
I think it's a pride thing. I think it's a bad attitude. I think it's he felt like he was more important, and then he was shown that he was just another cog in the wheel. But again, his answer was essentially a blog post on a drug form registered to an email address. Does that really say this is the Dread Pirate Roberts? This is really the guy that runs this whole site that has zero criminal history or record?
Even if it doesn't, he's got the best lead of all of them. And he's dealing with other agents who have phenomenal backgrounds in computer forensics and in internet and network security.
Yeah.
And he's the guy that breaks it open. And I guess he doesn't realize it. And so this is an opportunity that falls by the wayside.
Yeah. Chris Tarbell and the FBI, they will get a hold of a thumb drive from the Iceland government that literally has the entire Silk Road server on it, like a mirror image, a digital copy of it. When they first get a hold of the thumb drive, it's encrypted and they don't know how to get into it. And they're like, "Well, this is a dead end," and they're pissed off. Then one of the supervisors is like, "Well, didn't you get the password for it?" And they're like, "What password?" And this is days later after they got the thumb drive. And he says the passcode is, "Try to crack this, NSA." And I don't know if that passcode was set by the Iceland government to poke fun at the Americans, or if literally that was the encryption code that they set on the Silk Road server. I don't remember, but regardless, this is again showing how the government doesn't talk to each other. Like, they literally had the Silk Road server hand delivered to them by the Iceland government, but they didn't say, "Oh, here's the password for it." And there's a lot of shady allegations about how they got this copy of the server, and that the Iceland government went and hacked servers without warrants and whatnot. But just because they have a copy of the server doesn't exactly mean they have much, because everybody's going by aliases and pseudonyms and different names on the site. So they see transactions, they see accounts, but they don't know who anyone is.
But it is useful information, because when the government is trying to bring down a criminal organization, they need to understand how it works. So if you have a copy of the server, you can understand how it works. And then if you attempt to infiltrate that organization, now you have something to work with. Now you know the guidelines. Now you know how to conduct yourself. And I would say that's pretty crucial information.
Yeah. And what they did get was an IP address. This was, again, bad coding. And when you registered on the Silk Road site, you know, I think it was like a CAPTCHA or something, you know, when you have to type in those stupid letters when you register on a website. Somewhere in that code was the IP address of the Silk Road. And when they did a search for this IP address, they linked it back to a coffee shop in San Francisco. And it was called Mimo Toby's, I think. I might be pronouncing it wrong. Somebody had logged into the Wi-Fi at this coffee shop and accessed the Silk Road. So they're putting all these pieces together. Meanwhile, you have another department that intercepted a bunch of envelopes that had fake IDs in them. One envelope had 9 fake IDs, all with different names and states and locations, but all of them had the same picture. you know, because if you get a fake ID, it's got to look like you. All of them had Ross Ulbricht's picture on them, but every ID had a different name and different address. But they did have the address of Ross's apartment where he was living in San Francisco. But there was gentrification going on in San Francisco at the time. And so cross streets were mislabeled. So they kept going and knocking on the wrong person's door every time they were trying to confront the guy that was getting these fake IDs.
So you mean they didn't actually have maybe an officer from San Francisco go with them to help figure this out?
No. Okay. Eventually, they do go knock on Ross's door, and Ross will come out and talk to these two agents. His paranoia is off the charts. He's like, I'm caught. I'm screwed. I'm done for. But these two officers that show up say, hey, we're not going to arrest you. We're not going to do anything. It's a little suspicious. Somebody getting 9 fake IDs in the mail. We want to make sure you're not a terrorist. And Ross is like, oh, they don't know who they're talking to. They don't know who the hell I am. And so Ross is like, oh, yeah, yeah. I just got those fake IDs. And they're like, well, why do you need 9? And he's like, I just bought them. And they say, well, how would one obtain fake IDs on the internet? And this is how brazen Ross Ulbricht is. He says, well, one could go out and download the Tor browser, get on a VPN, and go out to this website called The Silk Road and buy fake IDs.
Yeah, but Justin, this is just like if you're out at a bakery and you're making small talk with the woman that runs it, and she says something like, you know, I just love listening to true crime podcasts. You being the host of a true crime podcast might say, so you must be listening to Generation Y podcast, right? And from there, I mean, you're just promoting your show. That's all he's doing, right?
Yeah.
Because the government does illegal stuff all the time. I'm sure they'd want to participate in this.
So he's totally upfront about how you buy fake IDs off the Silk Road without saying who he is. He gives them a fake name even. So they just take that. They file a report that they visited this address for fake IDs and they talked to a guy named Josh or something. But now it's on file.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Meanwhile, you have Carl and another guy who are jumping on the Silk Road and they're registered accounts. And Carl, our DEA agent, he's kind of gone rogue and he's registered an account called Nob, which was some biblical statement. He says he's a big time drug smuggler and he's talking to the Dread Pirate Roberts directly, and he offers to buy the site from him. And of course, this throws his supervisor and all the investigators in an outrage because they're all trying to investigate this guy, and this dude jumps on the site and just says, hey man, I'll buy the site from you. And at this point, Ross is doing pretty well for himself. Even though he's making so much money, his girlfriend Julia, who wanted to go out for like a nice dinner, well, he would take her to Taco Bell and still live out of his 2 bags and crappy apartments, but he's making money off Bitcoins. And at the time that the Silk Road started, Bitcoin was around $1, like 99 cents a Bitcoin. Towards the end of the saga of the Silk Road, 1 Bitcoin was worth about $400. So not only is Ross making money off commissions and drug deals, his Bitcoin has gone up 400 times. So he's making bank. The dude's worth millions. So when Carl says, hey man, I want to buy the site from you, Ross says, make me an offer. Of course, Carl says, well, give me your data sheets, your financials, so I can kind of appraise it and figure out what, you know, what the site is worth. Ross pretty much tells him, I'm not going to give you that information, but if it's not nine figures or better, I'm not interested, which means $100 million up to $1 billion. And I don't think Ross was undervaluing his site at this point. So he literally now has built and is running a multi-$100 million site. It's insane. And the government seems to be powerless to stop it. But the government has busted a few people that are affiliated with the site, whether they got drugs sent to their house or they were moderators, stuff like that.
So sometime in 2013, a man by the name of Curtis Green has been identified and taken into custody. Now, he's one of Silk Road's moderators, and we talked about those earlier. He just like folds immediately, starts cooperating with authorities with this task force and turning over his login credentials. He explains how he logs into the site. He explains how to use the site. So as a moderator, that involves resetting passwords or changing status of user accounts or even resetting pins. Basically, he's giving them everything. This is going to start a whole other issue with Silk Road, but he explains to a couple of guys who will misuse this information how to move Bitcoin and how to hide it. Imagine this, you have a criminal organization that's pulling in tons of money. And then one of the moderators who's been given elevated credentials is now in custody and giving up the goods. So even though he doesn't know who's running the site, he's able to give all of these agents access. And so the problem is, it's like anything else. You have people who will use information for good. You'll have people who use the information for criminal activities. And so these guys, all these agents now have access to all of this Bitcoin, essentially.
Millions of dollars worth.
And there are a couple of agents here who are not on the side of good. And their names are Carl Force, which we already talked about him, and then a Secret Service special agent by the name of Sean Bridges. Each of these two agents, independent of one another, will start exploiting the Dread Pirate Roberts and Silk Road. Mark Force starts using aliases. He was already using the name Knob, and that's how he was sort of infiltrating Silk Road. But he was using aliases to work to get money out of Ross Ulbrich in different ways. I mean, this is actually kind of a brilliant thing. So using an alias, he extorted $250,000 from Ross by telling him he wouldn't provide certain information to the task force that was investigating Silk Road if he paid up.
Literally, Carl Forrest is now a turncoat. He is now a double agent and telling Ross, I work for the government that's investigating you and you need to pay me.
Yeah, and basically you'll be safer because now this information I'm sitting on, well, I'll just keep sitting on it. But then he also uses other aliases. One of them is French Maid. He offers to give Ross certain information about the investigation into Silk Road if he pays $100,000.
It's extortion.
So Ross doesn't know that this is the same person. He just thinks there are different people involved now, and he's so paranoid about the government getting to him, and because he makes so much money, he figures, well, he'll just pay up and he'll be safe. It's kind of like when the mob enters your shop and, you know, they might break a vase or something, and they're saying, you know, a lot of stuff could get damaged around here, but if our pockets were lined a little bit, your shop would be safe.
You're paying us for protection, but it's protection against them.
So whether he was extorting or being bribed, Force would then move the money to his own personal accounts. So at this point, he can't even say later if he's caught, oh, well, this is just part of my investigation. He can't do that because now he's moving this money he's gotten to personal accounts.
This doesn't set off any red flags or anything.
Well, no one knows about it.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is because since this is such a new thing, no one was really prepared to deal with it. Do you know what I mean? Like even investigating it, we had Alfred who came along and said, oh, I'm kind of curious about this. And then just within a matter of moments figures out, unbeknownst to himself, but he figures out who's running the whole thing. These guys, and no one really knew how to figure this out. I think it gave him a certain protection there. But Carl doesn't stop there because he has big dreams, I think. So he attempts to move this digital currency, this Bitcoin, to better conceal it. And so he also invests in a Bitcoin exchange, and it's CoinMKT. I think it's like $110,000. And he becomes the de facto compliance officer for them. So since he's a government agent, now he can do background checks on people. So anyone dealing with that site, he can check over them and make sure they're good to go for the site. So it's a safety thing. While he's in this position to do that, he also has CoinMKT freeze an account. He says, this account is shady. You need to freeze it. This guy who has quite a bit of Bitcoin, his account gets frozen. And then Carl Force moves all of the guy's Bitcoins out into his own account. And that was worth about $297,000 worth at the time. And he used his supervisor's own signature stamp to attempt to free up his own account at Venmo, where his account had been frozen because they had questioned his credentials and his activity. They were like, something's up with this. So some other de facto compliance officer had a problem with his account, froze it, and then he used his supervisor's credentials to try and force them to unfreeze his account. Like, you have my authorization to unfreeze it.
I mean, I realize there's no honor amongst thieves, but Ross and Silk Road, at least they were like, we have a product, you buy a product. It's all fair. If somebody rips you off, we have a rating system and we ban them from the site. Carl's just a thief and he's abusing his power. I don't agree with what any of these people are doing.
So his activity started in 2013. Also in 2013, Secret Service agent Sean Bridges is using the login credentials and getting into Silk Road. In fact, as soon as he got them, he seemed to be moving on Bitcoin that belonged to the Dread Pirate Roberts. And on February 12th, he formed Quantum International Investments LLC, and he opened an account at Fidelity Investments so he could accept funds from Mt. Gox.
Launder.
Now, Mt. Gox was a Bitcoin exchange. It was the largest Bitcoin exchange for a time, and it was based in Japan. Well, Mt. Gox, and I'll try to keep this brief because this could be another episode probably, but they started getting hacked. And unfortunately, Mt. Gox on June 19th of 2011 suffered a hacker attack, which caused Bitcoin's value on that exchange to fall to 1 cent each. Okay, so just imagine Bitcoin being worth quite a bit of money now falling to 1 cent. And this was a temporary thing. It lasted just minutes. But in that time, a lot of Bitcoin went out the window, right? And then later in October of 2011, more breaches. Okay. So in the initial breach, they lost about 25,000 Bitcoins. The total loss for Mt. Gox for those who had accounts there was $8.75 million. So troubles continued. And finally, on February 7th of 2014, Mt. Gox had to halt all Bitcoin transactions, all withdrawals. Then it went completely dark and shut down on February 24th, 2014. The next day they announced they were done. So get this, Sean Bridges was trying to move his Bitcoin out of Mt. Gox. But prior to this, he had gone to his superiors and said, I know Mt. Gox is having a lot of troubles, and I know we're going to end up serving a warrant, a seizure warrant. I want to be the guy that takes it. On May 9th, 2013, just 2 days after he moved his money out, he served a seizure warrant to Mt. Gox and all of its owners' accounts. He would then move $250,000 worth from his Fidelity account to a personal account at a bank under another name. And this is because at the time, his own task force was under investigation.
He put his money in Mt. Gox to launder it and conceal it. Then he knows they're about to be raided because he's the one serving the warrant. So he pulls his money out, which is insider trading, and then he serves the warrant against them.
This is just making it very clear that when these guys are investigated, when that happens, that they were taking advantage of their positions and their knowledge and exploiting it for personal gain. It had nothing to do with the investigation. They could have used their information for good, but they used it for bad.
Because at the same time, Jared, our customs agent, he was able to entice another moderator on the site to give up her address and her identity. And then he turned her into an informant and he logs in with her account and starts getting insider information about the Silk Road using a mod account. But guess what Jared doesn't do? Embezzle and steal Bitcoin.
So Curtis Green was a moderator on Silk Road. Ross, the Dread Pirate Roberts, is losing Bitcoin. So someone's stealing from him. And he has it in his mind that it's Curtis Green who's stealing the Bitcoin from him.
But he really has it in his mind that it's Curtis because he's being told that by these other accounts ran by Carl. And he doesn't quite know that Curtis has been busted, but he thinks that Curtis is stealing the Bitcoin when really it's Carl stealing the Bitcoin and then lying about it and saying it's Curtis. Carl is playing this drug smuggling bad guy and he's talking to the Dread Pirate Roberts and he says, "Hey, what do you want me to do? I know people. We could take care of this thief who's stealing your Bitcoin, right?" And Ross is like, "Yeah, I'll pay you to take care of this." A lot of these IMs and chats are being conducted on a encrypted chat room. So even the government who has a copy of the server can't see these interactions. Now, Carl has persuaded Ross that he needs to do something against thieves because if he shows weakness, then he'll just be taken advantage of and that they have to take care of Curtis Green. Carl Force and Agent Bridges devise a plan to fake Curtis Green's murder and they tell Curtis, "Okay, we're going to have to rough you up and make it look real. Be very convincing. Otherwise, the Dread Pirate will catch on." So they actually beat Curtis Green and torture him for real. And they drowned him in a tub. They beat him. They bruise him up real good. This isn't proper police procedure. And then they take photos of him as if he's dead. And they are paid by Ross for this hit that they have performed. There are other allegations that Ross had other hits done on members of the Silk Road or other people, but this is the one that's documented the best. So they have the Silk Road server, and by the way, the server is called Frosty. And remember, Ross had registered his name as Frosty on some of these drug sites. So there's a connection. They also know that he's functioning out of America. They can check out his posts on the Silk Road and know his movements going off of those. And our old IRS friend, Gary Alford, he just has that gnawing feeling that I know this is Ross. I know I found this guy. And he goes back and he has the office rerun Ross's name. And all of a sudden, the fake ID report pops up. Gary's like, what is that? Some agents went and talked to some guy about 9 fake IDs in San Francisco. So he takes that information to Chris Tarbell and says, "I think this is the guy." And Chris Tarbell says, "Well, where was this guy in San Francisco?" And they look up his name, they look up his address, and lo and behold, it's down the street from that coffee shop that was the only record of him logging in to the Silk Road. And they're like, this has to be the guy. We have his name. We have him in San Francisco, a block away from where he logged in at a coffee shop. It's just, it all makes sense to them. We have Frosty, that's the name of the server, and we have his Gmail account, and we have him logging in San Francisco. So they take all this information and they start to go after Ross. But Ross is kind of an elusive little bugger and he protects himself. So they know that his laptop is encrypted and they can't just go kick in his door with a SWAT team, because all he has to do is just close the lid of his laptop and they can't get him in the act. They have to like get him with his fingers on the keyboard somehow. So they devise a plan.
So they're keeping an eye on Ross's place. They're able to track him from his house to a library in San Francisco known as the Glen Park Public Library.
Because he always connected from free Wi-Fi spots. He never connected from home.
He sits down and he opens up the laptop and he starts working with it. Because they know his laptop is secured, Justin just explained how they need to catch him using Silk Road, essentially. So they have a couple of FBI agents who appear to be a middle-aged Asian couple who are arguing in the library, and they're getting more and more animated. And finally, the woman yells something out and Ross turns his head. He doesn't know it, but there's an FBI agent waiting right by who will jump over and grab his laptop. He's essentially distracted. That's the moment that he's exposed.
So they grab his laptop. He's logged in to the Silk Road and they take him down to the ground and arrest him. But they need to plug it in or do something with it right away, because, you know, the screensaver can go on, you know, the battery can die. So they have to take this laptop directly to their IT forensics team and have it analyzed immediately, because they're on a short time frame. You know, what if he didn't have it plugged in? You know, it's like your battery on your phone. You know, it could be on 15%. So they have to move quickly. He's logged in as his Dread Pirate Roberts account.
It's a perfect execution of a plan.
Now, Ross, he's got a lot of money, so he can hire some good legal representation. But the evidence against him is overwhelming, to say the least. They have his social media profiles of Ross, and then they have his DPR IMs and chats, and they sync up perfectly with, I'm going to Thailand this weekend and going away, or I'm taking a trip to Australia. And then they go check out DPR's account on the Silk Road, and he's like, okay, everybody, run the show while I'm gone. I'm going to Australia. Completely matches up. He will have this facade that he sold the site and there was another Dread Pirate Roberts that took over. But when you check all the IMs and all the logs and everything, and him literally on his computer logged in as DPR when they arrest him, it's pretty obvious that he was still running the site. His defense is trying to say that they need to change venues. You know, he's not going to get a fair trial because, you know, this New York senator has already gone on the national stage and said that we need to shut the site down and this is the guy that runs it. The judge will not allow the defense the strategy of Ross wasn't running the site, which I find that kind of questionable, because I think, okay, I didn't murder that person, but now you're going to tell my defense team your strategy can't be that you didn't murder that person. So that's kind of crappy. They filed a motion for discovery, and the prosecutor sat on like 7,500 documents against Ross and didn't release them until like 2 days before the trial began. So Ross wasn't able to establish any sort of defense. Also, we have these two agents that have gone rogue and have been stealing and doing all these really corrupt things. Ross's defense team is not privy to this or is disallowed from using any of their evidence against him, because the judge is like, nope, that's not your problem. It's a separate issue.
But in the defense's opinion, the illegal activities by these agents expose problems with the investigation. In other words, if they had login credentials for Silk Road and were exploiting money out of it or using Silk Road, then they were actually helping to operate it.
Yeah. They could have literally taken over the pirate's account, you know, the captain's account, and been functioning as the captain. They had access to do that. Again, I don't think they did, but his defense is neutered. Now, the other thing the prosecution does, which I'm sorry, I'm not even trying to defend Ross here, but I just have problems. Like, you can nail this guy to the wall. You don't have to play all these dirty tricks. The beginning of the trial, they read off his charges, and there's a whole litany of charges. Accessory to murder, causing death. They're saying that he was responsible for, I don't remember the kid's name, but he was in Australia. Somebody bought drugs off the Silk Road. They go to this hotel party and they give or sell the drugs to another kid who takes them and then freaks out and jumps out a window. And they're like, well, the drugs came from the Silk Road. Therefore, Ross Ulbricht is responsible. If you think selling drugs is despicable, I'm not going to fight you on it. I think heroin and these hard drugs are not good for society, but sometimes criminalizing things is worse than treating the addiction. But in this case, if you're setting that kind of precedent, if I were to sell you some drugs through Facebook, are we going to go and arrest Mark Zuckerberg because I sold drugs on Facebook? Now, I realize that the whole point of Silk Road is to buy and sell drugs, but Ross merely created a website. I think there's a little bit of shadiness there, but they go after Ross with drug kingpin laws. This is what they go after, drug cartels and big time offenders. But by the end of the trial, a lot of those charges that they read off at the beginning of the trial, like these two murder for hires, those charges are gone now. So it's like planting a seed with the jury. You know, they might as well have said, this guy's a child molester and parks illegally. And then by the end of the trial, they're like, okay, the only charge is parking illegally. Oh, you think he's a child molester, but we're not charging him with that. I find that kind of shady. It was very emotion driven. And I'm just thinking to myself, you guys had this guy nailed to the wall. You had him for money laundering, for fraud, for tax evasion, for drug trafficking. Why do you have to play games here? Ross will end up getting two life sentences plus 40 years without the possibility of parole. Now, some of you might think that's just for what he did because a lot of people's lives were destroyed by the drugs sold on his site. I get that. But his prison sentence is harsher than what we give murderers and rapists, violent offenders. And the way they went about it, I feel he deserves an appeal. And it's not that I think that this guy's innocent. It's not that I think that he wasn't the Dread Pirate Roberts. I just think they railroaded him using really crappy tactics and shutting down his defense.
They may have used what you call shady tactics to get him the worst possible sentence that they could give him. I mean, we know he was the Dread Pirate Roberts. And during the trial, it came out exactly how that operation went down to get his laptop. The Homeland Security officer we mentioned earlier, Jared Derryahyan, he was actually outside the library and communicating with Dread Pirate Roberts, telling him to get on Silk Road, essentially. So once he verified that he was logged in, because they would use a chat client, that's when they knew they could pounce. It was actually a brilliant operation. And so there was no doubt about this guy and his guilt. But I think, Justin, your whole point is they could just bust this guy, but they really wanted to just demonize him and then completely destroy him. It was almost like a personal vendetta instead of just, well, we're doing our jobs.
Well, he made the government look stupid. He used the Tor network built by the government against them. And he did it for a few years, or at least 2 years. Now, there are some superstar agents here, like Jared and Chris Tarbell, that came in and kicked ass. But then you see the temptation and the corruption of other agents. I see the unfairness of his trial, and I think, now you bring into question. I think he got a crappy trial. I think the process should prevail. I guess that's sort of the moral here is, Ross felt that, why let process get in the way of progress? I'm going to make drugs legal. Meanwhile, you have Jared trying to do his job and trying to bust this site. And he's not going to let process get in the way of progress. So he goes around the system and goes after him. Then you have somebody like Carl Force, who switches sides mid-investigation. I look at it and I just think, well, of course. Why wouldn't they do this on the up and up at the end? So what happened to our friends Carl Force and Mr. Bridges?
Because this laptop was seized and they didn't have to worry about encryption anymore because it was open and on, they were able to find logs of communications between Ross Ulbrich and Carl Force. This is important because they actually check back against the records that Force sent in. And he was filing reports on all his dealings with Silk Road, or so they thought. Once they started comparing the logs on the laptop versus his reports, they discovered a lot of communications, and under different aliases, of course, between these two that Force had never reported on. They really have him nailed, and they know that all of this secret business that he was doing on the side was all illegal, and it was all for personal gain. On May 28th of 2014, Sean Bridges is first interviewed by phone regarding this investigation into the task force. So they just want to ask him some questions, and they ask him about Carl Force. I mean, at this point, they know that Carl Force is dirty, and they're trying to figure out where Sean Bridges fits into everything. He denies knowing him very well. He said, we're on the same task force, but we don't really communicate. And they also ask him if he's owned any Bitcoin in the past year. And he denies that as well. That's kind of weird, right? They set up a second interview. During this one, they're asking him about his Quantum International Investments LLC. And he says, oh, that was just a personal business venture and it didn't really work out. They're able to look into a lot of these things and they find out he's not telling the truth. In March of 2015, he's told that he's being suspended. And he knows the gig's up, I think. So he actually resigns. When you resign from a job, Justin, especially when you have a job with sensitive information involved, then they want to make sure that you don't carry anything out the door with you, right?
Yeah.
Well, in Sean Bridges' case, they said, we want you to leave your laptops over here. He says, okay. And he sets a laptop down where they tell him to, but then he takes the other one and he puts it on a shelf, which is known as the wipe shelf. You leave laptops there or computers that you want to be wiped clean. Okay. I don't think this is an accident because he managed to get one laptop where it was supposed to go. Then he had also said, hey, before I go, I have some personal information I want to take off of a computer that I use. And he got authorization to do so. That's because they would be watching him. He had a folder on this computer and it was labeled Bitstamp. As he's trying to copy it off, they show up and they shut everything down.
So they catch him in the middle of the act of trying to conceal and steal more Bitcoin and conceal his own theft. Okay.
Yeah, they know he's guilty. Of course, they've got Carl Force, they've got Sean Bridges. These guys really have no defense. Force pleads guilty on July 1st, 2015. It's on three different charges: money laundering with predicates of wire fraud and theft of government property, obstruction of justice and extortion under color of official right related to his theft, and diversion of more than $700,000 in digital currency, which he gained by being part of an undercover task force that was investigating Silk Road. And on October 19th of 2015, he was sentenced to 78 months in prison, which was kind of a compromise between what the prosecution wanted and what his defense was saying, which was they wanted him to have the minimum, which I think was 60 months or something like that. So they gave him something in between. Near the end of 2015, Sean Bridges pleads guilty. He goes down for charges of obstruction of justice and money laundering, and he gets a sentence of 71 months. In 2016, on January 28th, which is the day before he's supposed to turn himself in to serve his sentence, he's arrested again.
What? A second time?
Yeah, you'd think if he'd already pled guilty, he'd already been interviewed, and he basically gave up all the information on what he had been doing, you would think that would be the end of the story. But apparently, Sean Bridges didn't give up everything because they found more money laundering and they had to arrest him again. Not only that, but they found government property that he had stolen, including bulletproof vests.
This guy was making a run for it. He was going to try to leave the country, I think. And he had bulletproof vests because he was expecting an altercation. It really shows that if he's being arrested a second time, then the government might not know how far these two went and what they stole and what they got away with.
I guess when it comes to these agents, they couldn't resist the temptation of all this money that was right beneath their fingers. I mean, this is part of the defense that Ross and his defense team were trying to bring up, that they couldn't use these agents' illegal activities at trial. They're like, this is exculpatory because it's not like they just had access to Silk Road. They had access to everything. Who knows how much they participated in? So how come they're not being held as being responsible for this as well?
Yeah. And I can't even imagine what it's like to be an underpaid police officer busting some drug dealer that has hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you're sitting there busting your ass for, you know, $30,000, $40,000 a year, putting your life on the line. And this guy's got hundreds of thousands of dollars, or millions of dollars in this case. The temptation is unbelievable, I'm sure. I understand it, but it just kind of saddens me that, at least in this case, it was so brazen and just so over the top.
So this is a case that involved a first. It was the first time that we saw an illegal marketplace just explode on the internet and become more and more popular, making the guy that started it rich beyond his dreams. But of course, he didn't seem to be a guy that was doing this for the money, because it wasn't like he was going out and buying BMWs, was he?
No, he lived in crappy apartments with his two bags or a duffel bag of clothes. He didn't even have furniture most of the time. He didn't own a car.
This is not what we picture, though, Justin. When we watch a movie like Scarface, he's supposed to build an empire.
Yeah. Mountain of cocaine, 15 cars. And
AK.
Yeah. This is, say hello to my little friend. No. This is a cheesy, privileged white kid who looks granola. Is not the image of a drug cartel kingpin that they're trying to make him out to be.
And he's not utilizing his gifts. I mean, his educational background meant that he had a lot of great opportunities out there.
Yeah, just imagine if he would have used all this effort for a legit site.
Used it for science.
Yeah. There's a lot of points and morals of the story with this case. If anyone has the impression that I idolize Ross Ulbricht, I actually idolize a lot of characters in this story, not just him, because they're all very strong personalities that have drive, that are no BS kind of people that just want to cut through everything and just get a job done. And whether that be federal agents or Ross himself, I appreciate what they do. When it comes to the war on drugs, when it comes to whether drugs should be legal or not, the Silk Road wasn't just selling cocaine and heroin. People actually went out there and bought pain meds that they couldn't get from their doctor. They couldn't afford because their insurance won't cover it. There was more to the Silk Road than just the horribleness of guns and drugs. When you make something illegal, you create a criminal environment. I always joke that we should make caffeine illegal, because all hell would break loose and you would create a whole new criminal market for coffee and energy drinks. Starbucks become a drug cartel, and all you coffee drinkers would become users and dealers. And as ridiculous as that sounds, caffeine is a stimulant. But if you were to make caffeine illegal tomorrow, in this situation, I would consider that the legality of something or the government force to shut something down is worse than the use of the drug itself. Not that I think all drugs should be legal, because people were actually selling cyanide on the Silk Road. So no, I'm not cool with that at all. And I think the site should have been shut down and Ross should have been charged. But when it comes to just regular street drugs, especially when it comes to marijuana, which I don't smoke, but I find to be the most inert drug out there, you have to consider that. You have to consider where Ross was coming from, because the government coming down on alcohol or whatever makes the criminal element stronger. They create the bad guy and they give the bad guy power, and you criminalize legal behavior. This is what happens.
We did a premium episode on Annie Dukin, and because she was manipulating results in her tests, she tainted a bunch of criminal investigations where you can't trust her results and you can't trust her word. And so it causes a lot of issues for the authorities. Shawn Bridges, I brought up how he served a seizure warrant at Mt. Gox. Well, it turns out that over time, he was involved in a lot of other digital currency investigations. And because they know he's dirty as all get out, now he's probably ruined a lot of other investigations, because they can't just say, well, this investigation was done right. No, they have a corrupt officer who was involved. And now, because he was involved so much, those investigations are pretty much ruined. Again, just like with Annie Dukin, you have to wonder, why is it that good guys, who are supposed to be good guys, I say, that are corrupt, how come they get slaps on the wrist? It just seems like we're not making the stakes high enough where they'll even think about what they're doing. I mean, the temptation's too great. I mean, what's 6 years when you've been ripping everybody off?
Well, that's the whole point of being tough on crime, is the tougher the laws and, you know, having the death penalty is all a deterrent to keep people in line. But if the laws that we hold our officials to are much lighter sentences, then there's no deterrent for them.
So here's something to think about. They don't know that they got all of the money that Shawn Bridges got out, or even that Carl Force got out. So just imagine, these guys serve 6 years. When they get out, because they are going to get out, unlike Ross Ulbricht, they might have a lot of money waiting for them somewhere.
Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. We have no idea.
And I don't know if the government has any idea, or I don't even know if I trust them to keep an eye on these guys to see if they do access money. And do you trust the government to actually keep an eye on him and track this down if it happens?
I think that you have some superstars that do a great job, but then you have laziness, corruption, and silos that allow evil to take place. So if you are as obsessed with the Silk Road or cryptocurrency or the deep web as I was for a while, the book American Kingpin by Nick Bilton is phenomenal. And if you want to hear the impact that the Silk Road had on somebody personally, check out my Peripheral episode, The Path to Hell is Paved in Silk.
Hey everyone, this is Aaron. I want to thank you all for the outpouring of support. It's been kind of a rough time for Justin, and so we really appreciate your thinking of him. We had originally released this episode on our Patreon. This is where we release ad-free versions of our episodes as well as bonus content. You can find it at patreon.com/generationY. patreon.com/generationY. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. We'll be right back. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity, that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.